The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
So let's take a look at what I have in front of you. The primary source of this material comes from Schaff's Creeds of Christendom, Volume 1, 258 to 340. And I've attempted to synthesize the substance here so we can have a good working introduction to the elements that enter into the great controversies of the Lutheran tradition that give us their second great document and their Book of Concord. The first, obviously, is the Augsburg Confession. The second is the Formula of Concord. There are other things included, but this is, of course, a development of the Lutheran tradition in attempting to respond to all of the theological controversies that emerged following the Augsburg Confession's production. So, background. The era is from Luther's death, about 1546, to the Formula of Concord, 1577. So it's about a 30-year period that is incredibly fruitful in the statement of Orthodox Lutheranism. Obviously, part of the background are the differences between Luther and Melanchthon. The difference between these two men is very significant. And we've noted that earlier in our other discussions to see that Melanchthon was very much a transitional figure from authentic Luther's thought, if you will, to how he himself saw Lutheran theology and reflected it. So there are interesting implications of how these two men have worked together and how Melanchthon changes Luther's theology. We will be talking about some of that in our other lectures as well. So from 1533, two types of Lutheranism began to emerge. There's that directly from Luther, which is conclusive and exclusive, anti-Catholic, anti-Zwinglian. I mean, it's absolutely clear where Luther stood. But there is a Melanchthonian type of Lutheranism, which we can call expansive and unionistic. In other words, he's willing to grow beyond Luther, and he's also looking for rapprochement, that is friendship with those traditions that didn't quite fit in Luther's theology. So we find that in what we could call his synergism, which is a step away from his Augustinian roots in Luther. We talked a little bit about that last lecture. And he moved in the direction of Calvin in the sense of the Lord's Supper. So he was able to begin to see a Calvinistic understanding of the Lord's Supper as opposed to a Lutheran. Yes?
Of course, that's toward Calvin on one issue and away from him on another.
That's right. And so in context, when I say moving toward Calvin, it's on the Supper. And Calvin was keenly aware that early on, Melanchthon was not with him on the issue of the bondage of the will and sovereign predestination. I think there were some, in the French translation of the Loci Communis, that which was Melanchthon's classic treatise, this is in the 1540s somewhere, I think you can find remarks of Calvin that were appended to the French translation expressing, or at least in regard to it, his disappointment to see the different theology of Melanchthon showing here. Nevertheless, he saw him as an ally, which is interesting, because later on, some of the ideas of Melanchthon, when they come up at the Synod of Dort, will be condemned as Pelagianism. But at this stage, in the early Reformation, because of their common commitment for a Reformation, Calvin, while frustrated and disappointed, was still saw Melanchthon as a dear soulmate. Okay, so they were very close. Okay, Luther and Melanchthon were able to keep on friendly terms in spite of their differences, while trouble begins to brew in years from Luther's death until Melanchthon's death. So somehow Luther was able to overlook Melanchthon's obvious differences, and there were a number of them that were evident even in Luther's day. One of the most obvious examples was Luther's condemnation of Aristotle in the schools and Melanchthon's insistence on bringing Aristotle into the school in ethics. So there was theological differences from the very beginning. And nevertheless, Luther loved Melanchthon and was willing to just kind of overlook some of these things, which is one of the amazing things about Luther's character. So, but from about 1546, once Luther's protection of Melanchthon is kind of gone, and Melanchthon's kind of freer to develop his own thoughts without the shadow of Luther directly over him, the troubles really begin to brew in those about 14-year period. And it's in that time we begin to see some of these issues. So secondly, having looked at the background, let's talk about the Lutherans and what were called the Philippists. And that was one of the names, the followers of Philip Melanchthon. So we've looked at the idea of the conservative or rigid Lutherans that went under the title Genizio, the Genizio Lutheran tradition. And some of the leaders we have mentioned here of Amsdorf, Flacius would be some of the better known ones, and Heschusius and Westphal. Both of those were directly antagonists of Calvin on the Lord's Supper. So when you look at the treatises of Calvin, you'll find him interacting with Heschusius and Westphal. Okay. They were very polemical with Luther's doctrine, and the next list here, Andrei, Chemnitz, Selnecker, and others move for a moderation between the ultra-Lutherans from which they had developed and the Melanchthonians, which leads ultimately to the formula of Concord. So if you're wanting to think in Hegelian terms here, you can see the thesis, antithesis, and kind of compromise in the middle here, because you have the Genizio Lutherans and the Philippists, and out of the middle of that we find, particularly under Chemnitz, kind of a mediating influence that ultimately attempts to give us the formula of Concord as a position that stands in the middle, trying to balance the two. And obviously that's the way human life operates, so we don't want to put it into the absolute ideal of Hegel's thought here. But in give and take of opposite points, either we're going to destroy each other, we're going to find a grounds that we can have union. And so there was an attempt to bring a middle grounds. And so that has been one of the problems of the formula of Concord, is did they succeed in finding a legitimate middle ground, or is it a tenuous compromise? And that's part of the question mark when you evaluate the formula of Concord. Okay, what are the summary of the differences then? Both held to the supreme authority of the Bible. There is no question at this time that there is a biblical orthodoxy among both the Lutherans, Genizio Lutherans, and the Philippists. They claim to be biblically minded. The Genizio approach it this way. Luther's interpretation was final as he was seen as an almost inspired apostle. So Luther's theology was nearly venerated as an absolute position, so that you can find in the tradition where the Genizio Lutheran movement has been, Luther's writings are held so high that it's almost like God's word and Luther's writings forever. That's a motto that you can see on some of the old seminaries that are around. You know, Gottes Wort and Luther's Schrift evermehr, or something like that. It's forever. They're the standards, one and two, side by side, almost apostolic. Can't remember another poem. It's Gottes Wort und Luther's Schrift sind der Papists and Calvinist Gift. Okay, notice that. God's word and Luther's writing are the poison of the Papists and the Calvinists. Okay, they poison them, destroys them. So the idea that you can see how high Luther's writing is elevated. And in the Genizio Lutheran tradition, there's a tremendous veneration for Luther. The Philippists, however, had Melanchthon's interpretation before them, and yet he was considered only a great teacher, and they reserved room for disagreement with his teaching, and that is freedom in theological study. So the Philippists admired Melanchthon, but they never saw him as an apostle and venerated him with absolute authority. And so there was even freedom within the Philippist movement to say, well, we don't have to agree with everything that Melanchthon said, but we believe that he was on the right track. So you can see one of the ways to look at this movement is there is more of a humanist element in the Melanchthonian or Philippist side. They are freer scholarship, academic liberty, and freedom, as opposed to more of a strong creedal orthodox Luther theology. And so early on, there's already this kind of a dialectic, if you will, between the viewpoints. And out of that comes forth a tremendous debate, which will issue in the formula of Concord. Okay, let's go next now to talk about the theological controversies in the Lutheran Church. And I'm going to address these in the order that you find them in the Formula of Concord. Okay, so this will be a review or an introduction, as the case may be, to these controversies. The first is what has been called the Flacian controversy, named for Matthias Flacius Illyricus. And it's the controversy on original sin. And it actually breaks out in 1560, and it's in about a 20-year debate. And so you recognize 1560 is the year of Melanchthon's death. So really, with Melanchthon's death, this issue breaks out. And it's really an outgrowth of the synergistic controversy with Melanchthon himself helped start. Obviously, by moving away from the Augustinian bondage of the will, Melanchthon was one of the forces to bring this about. The basic question is this: is original sin essential, that is, part of man's nature, or accidental, a corruption of human nature? That almost sounds very scholastic, doesn't it? Is it essential or accidental? And you can see, for the very form of the question to occur, you see the impact of scholasticism as a theological model impacting itself upon the Lutheran tradition. So I don't think this kind of a question would have occurred if it had only been Luther's influence. This is Melanchthon's shape. He is dealing with the traditional Aristotelian thought forms and trying to bring them to bear upon Lutheran theology. So the question has a scholastic ring. Is original sin essential or accidental? Flacius's teaching put it this way: as an inference of total depravity, original sin is seen as part of human nature, and man is no longer in any sense the possessor of God's image, only the image of salvation. Salvation, therefore, is to receive a new and holy nature. And so when you think about this, then, if we believe in total depravity, Flacius says that we have entirely lost the image of God, that there is nothing left of the image, and so that we must see that original sin is part of human nature. To be a human being is to not have the image of God, but it is to instead have original sin. That is what it is to be inherently human, to have original sin. So now, as you look at that issue, the question is, obviously, where did Luther stand on the Imago Dei? Was the image there part, the image of God, and totally gone? Okay, well, what does the form of Concord do on this? Well, this view is rejected. This seemed to leave the alternatives that either Satan created man or that God was thus made the author and preserver of sin, which, of course, was a charge often made against the Calvinistic answer, and they didn't want to be seen as Calvinistic. So basically, the summary of their position is as follows: it is not the moral essence or substance or nature of man, as Flacius taught with the old Manichaeans. See, they say this is almost a Manichaean heresy at work here, but a radical corruption of that nature which can never be entirely eradicated in this world, and thereby guarding themselves against the Pelagian and semi-Pelagians. So in substance, what they're trying to say is that original sin is accidental and not essential to human nature. They reject Flacius's position. And what they're trying to do, though, is affirm the sense that man is still somehow, in some sense, an image bearer of God and was created perfectly, and that original sin is not inherent to his nature. It is an accident. So then that opens the door then to, well, how do you define the image? And I think one of you are talking about working on this, so you can see the Flacian controversy is very important as you deal with it. Have you come across that already in your research? Yep, okay. Okay, so you can see, Fong, as you work on your paper, you'll want to address this whole problem of the Flacian controversy, and it's the first article. Okay, so I'll just share that with you. It's a rather complex issue to summarize quickly, but let's go on. There's a very related issue then, and it's natural that item two that we would find in the ordering of the form of Concord would be the synergistic controversy. Original sin and synergism obviously play off on one another. You recognize then the word synergism means this idea of a working together, that man has something to do in his salvation as well as God. Calvinism has taught monergism, that is, that is a one-sided act of a sovereign God bringing life to a dead man, spiritually speaking. That seems to me what Luther was teaching also in the bondage of the will. So synergism is a movement away from a single-sided redemptive work of God to God doing maybe most of it, but man having a minor but significant role in his salvation. Okay, so the question then, simply put, what is the relationship of man's freedom of the will to God's converting grace? Is there room for the freedom of the will if God's grace is necessary in a man's conversion? Well, Melanchthon in his 1548 Loci had given three causes of conversion: the Spirit of God, the Word of God, and human will. Now, what's significant is that the Spirit of God and the Word of God were in his original edition of 1521. It's in his 1548 edition that he adds the human will. Okay, so there's a clear change and movement in Melanchthonian theology. The doctrine of Word and Spirit is a fundamental union in Protestant theology in its original form, that you can't have one without the other if there's divine agency. God always works through the Word. The Word is always coupled, either in its condemning character or its regenerating character, with the Spirit. They go together. Melanchthon says that's insufficient to explain salvation. We must see a real room for the human will. And it's in 1548, then, that we begin to see the presence of the synergism element that human will enters at. Okay, so a gentleman by the name of Pfeffinger at Leipzig advocates it in an academic dissertation, that is, freedom of will, in 1550, which is 2 years after the publication of Melanchthon's Loci Communis. And as the case often is, it's the student that gets the professor into an interesting problem, because he's saying, this is not my, I'm just defending a thesis that's been developed by someone of reputation. Okay? And he publishes a work in 1555 to defend the freedom of the will. Okay? It is significant that there were others in Wittenberg, Luther's own domain, of by the name of Major, Hebert, and Krell, and Striegel and Jena, who advocated a limited freedom in the fallen man as a rational and responsible being, namely the power to accept or reject the prevenient grace of God. And his illustration Pfeffinger used was a penny paid by a man toward a very large debt paid by God. In other words, he wanted to say, it's as though you had $1 million debt and you only paid a penny of it and God did the rest. So it's utterly insignificant, yet it's real. So there was no notion that was like a 50-50 enterprise. Just a very minor but significant, you can't ignore it, that penny was paid. And that was how he put it. Now, Amsdorf, Flacius, Wigand, and Heschusius appealed to Luther and argued that man is totally corrupt and he can only resist God. But by God's Spirit, man is converted against and in spite of his perverse will, or he receives a new will, and therefore unconditional election and reprobation must be maintained, as Luther taught. Okay? So at this point, you can see they recognize that Melanchthon has started a new direction. Someone by the name of Pfeffinger has moved it, and there's a rejection of that. Okay? And so further, we must come along to Article 2. We'll skip over Point 5 because that's a little, will be time delaying to explain that fully. So let's just go to Point 6 here. Article 2 of the Formative Concord rejects both views without trying to solve the difficulty, and that it asserts that man in sin is a block or stock, okay, which is the anthropological premise of Luther's bondage of the will. When it comes to spiritual life, we have about as much will as a block of wood. Okay, we don't have any ability. But it rejects the absolute predestination and reprobation, which, by the way, was Luther's theological conclusion. It's where he maintained in the bondage of the will. And as it does that, it basically creates an inconsistency. And so the Formative Concord wants to say, yes, man does not have will. He does not contribute his penny. But it refuses to go to the conclusion that Luther was willing to go to in the Reformed tradition. That means that God is therefore absolutely sovereign in man's conversion. And it doesn't resolve the tension. It decides to draw the tension with, we don't hold to absolute predestination and reprobation, but we do hold to the bondage of the will. Okay, so that's an interesting point where they put the dilemma. For the Calvinist, it's not that we solve all the problems. We go to the logical conclusion of absolute sovereign grace and reprobation, but we still recognize there's responsibility. But man contributes no penny, but yet he's responsible. There's still a tension here. We draw the tension at a different point. And so while it may be interesting from a Reformed view to say, well, how can you deal with this tension? And it is an interesting question. A Reformed person still must recognize there's an inscrutable mystery at some point that we can never finally put together perfectly, man's responsibility and God's sovereignty. There's a basic tension. And for Calvin, in his writings, he says there's a point where we just stop and worship and say, you know, God is sovereign. Okay, so there's no easy explanation here. But the Lutheran tradition in the form of Concord stops short of Luther's view and puts the tension here that we'll hold to the bondage of the will, but we will not move on to the sovereign predestinating work of God. And so I put it in number 7. Note this inconsistency then in the form of Concord. If a man is by nature like a stone and block and unable to accept the grace of God, which is maintains in Article 2, he therefore needs to be converted by an act of almighty power and irresistible grace, which is denied later in Article 11. If some are saved without the cooperation on their part, while others with the same inability and the same opportunities are lost, the difference points to a particular predestination and the inscrutable decree of God. On the other hand, if God sincerely wills the salvation of all men, as Article 11 teaches, and yet only a part are actually saved, there must be some difference in the attitude of the saved and the lost towards converting grace, which is denied in Article 2. Thus, an attempt to stand between Augustinianism and Arminianism is made here, and it's a difficult one. It's one that a Reformed mind can't accept. It says you've got to go one way or the other and deal with the tension elsewhere. But Lutheranism wants to stand somewhere in the middle between Arminius and Augustine. Okay, really, and I would like to say between Arminius and Luther, because Luther was Augustinian, okay, as I see it. So there, one of the ways you can look at the form of Concord is that it does find a middle ground, but it creates an inherent tension, a tension that's unacceptable to, I think, Luther and really to the Augustinian mind in general. Okay, let's go into a third item as we summarize. We've got a lot of material if we're going to summarize this whole form of Concord. So the first two go together very nicely, and obviously the synergistic controversy is pointing us to another view, which is Article 11, which we've anticipated here, which is over the sovereign predestinating grace of God. Okay, we come thirdly to the Osiandric controversy. Okay, the Lutherans were really theologizing back here, big issues, and they're fighting over them. And this occurs in about 1549 to 1566. The synergistic controversy has almost the same period of time. You notice that was 1550 to 67. So the question under Osiander's tutelage is this: is justification by faith merely a forensic acquittal of sin or an actual infusion of righteousness? Do you remember we noted earlier that it seems as though there may be a kind of an ambiguity in Luther's teaching? And Melanchthon says, well, justification can kind of mean either depending on the context. I've not worked that out with precision, but I've tried to point you to several passages where it seems that that's a problem in the early development. And Osiander is going to try to nail it down now. The question is justification by faith forensic acquittal, or is it an actual infusion of righteousness? Okay, now how does he come at this? Luther taught a clear distinction between justification and sanctification, the former an external act of God for man, the latter is an internal act of God in man. Now, that's if you read Luther with the best possible grace, because I'm not sure I want to say it quite that well. I'm reflecting Schaff's thought here when I put that there. I question that a little bit. But nevertheless, you can see that there's something of a distinction between the two. And while the two are inseparable, as sanctification was a necessary result of justification. And for Luther, really, sanctification is faith working itself out and not so much the element of obedience to the law with a new nature. So keep that in mind. The Osiandric controversy either confounded justification and sanctification or else too abstractly separated them, and the person of Christ was lost sight of in one of his two natures or in his person or in his work. Now, trying to translate that into better language, read number 4 because I think it's better said here. He taught, going to the second sentence of 4, a medicinal and creative act whereby the sinner is made just by an infusion of the divine nature of Christ. Okay? Now, understand what the infusion is here. It is not if you will, a sanctifying nature that justifies you, which would make it Roman Catholic justification, okay? Because Catholicism says you're justified for your sanctified life. You're declared righteous as you do the best you can as God's grace helps you. Here, it is not that. It is an infusion of righteousness that you are justified for, but it is not a forensic declaration. It is actually the nature of Christ in you. It is Jesus being in you that is declared righteous. Okay? And I think you can see some of that in Luther also. So this earlier statement, number two, that's why I qualified it. You can see Luther going both ways, and I think that's really with the clarification of Melanchthon working with him that you begin to see that. For example, in one of the other statements we read the week before. But so here I think Osiander says, the reason we are justified is because the divine nature of Christ is infused into us. And God sees Christ in us and he declares us righteous because of Jesus' presence. And therefore, he's distancing himself from the idea of a forensic declaration. And as this debate has continued, some people have said forensic justification is a legal fiction. You ever hear that language? That you are being declared righteous without a righteousness. Because there's no righteousness in you. How can God declare you righteous when you aren't? You are not righteous. It's legal fiction. The only way you can be declared righteous is if you actually have a righteousness, and that is only possible because of Christ's presence. So that is the way that argument is still debated sometimes in justification theology among evangelicals. I've heard that idea being debated periodically through different sources. And so Osiander is trying to distance himself from the gradualism of the sanctification-justification union of Rome. He's saying, no, it is not a gradual human effort where he's doing better and better and God declares him righteous for doing what he does in his sanctification process. This is an act, but it is a real act because there is an infused righteousness in you because the nature of Christ is in you.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the cassette over at this point.
What and how much should be yielded to the papists? As far as I'm concerned, too much has already been yielded in this apology. If they reject it, I see nothing that might be yielded beyond what has been done, unless I see the proofs they proffer and clearer Bible passages than I have hitherto seen. As I have always written, I am prepared to yield everything to them if we are but given the liberty to teach the gospel. I cannot yield anything that militates against the gospel. Now, what do we find there? Luther's response to the Augsburg Confession is that, Melanchthon, you've been too kind. Again, to the very last words at the bottom of page 2, the image of God was found in the essential union of the human nature with the divine nature and on the necessity of the incarnation, which in his opinion would have taken place even without the fall. So Osiander's teaching was that there would have been an incarnation even if man had never sinned. Okay? In order that through Christ's humanity we might become partakers of the essential righteousness of God. The incarnation was always necessary, and true righteousness was God was always through union with Christ, and that was with sin or without sin, and we are declared righteous, therefore, by participating in that true union of Christ's nature with us. Now, you can see how that would tie in very nicely with the sacramental theology of Lutheranism. That in a sense, in the Lord's Supper, we are receiving the body and blood, human and also divine nature of Christ, which is partially what is being declared righteous. Okay, it's our union. So justification and the Lord's Supper are very visibly tied together in Osiander's type of thought. Okay, he was, however, opposed by both parties, that is, by the Gnesio-Lutherans and the Philippists, as a Romanizer. The Königsberg professors had to carry firearms to class, and it was circulated and seriously believed that the devil wrote Osiander's books while he enjoyed his meals. Interesting thoughts were going on at that time. So they feared for their lives because of the teaching that they were holding. And the myth was circulating that the devil was writing Osiander's work. So they opposed him because they saw it as a Romanizing tendency, because of the fact that there was an infused righteousness. So there's a lot of interesting debate going on in this early time. So that, by the way, this sparked two collateral controversies that occurred in the midst of this. One is called the Stancarian dispute after Francesco Stancaris, and the second one is called the Parsimonious or Carg dispute. And let's say just a brief word about both of them as you trace out the history here. The Stancarian dispute basically came from this gentleman who was an ex-priest from Italy and was also a professor at Königsberg. He refuted Osiander by using Peter Lombard's idea that Christ was our mediator and redeemer according to his human nature only, since he, being God himself, could not mediate between God and God. He called his opponents and all the reformers ignoramuses. See, this got pretty hot, this debate. They were carrying firearms, accusing the devil of writing it. His opponent was calling him an ignoramus. And his approach was that you must look at this whole idea of righteousness as Christ-centered, that there is a forensic justification, but in the defense, he developed the notion that Christ was a mediator only according to his human nature. And so you can see he began to move to separating the natures of Christ too strenuously for the satisfaction of the Lutheran theologians. Comment.
So he would probably hang out on the text, there's one God and one mediator between God and man, from man, right?
That's right. That would have been the central text in his debate. He'd say it was Christ in his humanity that would do this. Now you see, for a Lutheran theologian, though, they desperately wanted to keep the two natures incredibly united because they wanted to argue for the real presence in the most visible way. So in this debate, then, the Stancarian dispute, in trying to defend something, he loosened another issue that Lutheranism was very keen to defend. Okay? So that was a subordinate issue that came out of this one. And you can see why Melanchthon invented the phrase, I think it was the rabies theologicorum, the madness of the theologians, theological rabies, if you will, the mad dog theology, because they were foaming at the mouth everywhere in this time, debating right and left. Okay, the parsimonious debate, or Karg, his name was either one, his German or his Latin name. He's a Lutheran minister in Bavaria. And in the middle of the Osiandric controversy, as he was involved with it, he derived redemption entirely from our Lord's passive obedience and denied that his active obedience had any vicarious merit, since Christ himself as man owed active obedience to God. He also opposed the doctrine of imputation and resolved justification into the idea of remission of sins. So that's, again, if you let that all sink in, what he's basically doing now is picking up on the dispute of the human and divine nature issue again, which Osiander was trying to argue was the basis of justification, that Christ's presence is in man. Here he argues that in Christ's life, righteousness is entirely dependent upon the work of the cross, as Christ is suffering, and not in his act of obedience, because as a man he had to do that to be the perfect man. And therefore it had no vicarious benefit. He was just allowing himself to become able to become a worthy sacrifice on the cross. And that had therefore no redemptive benefit, but it was necessary for himself to become an adequate atonement. Okay? And in the process of this, he therefore opposed the doctrine of imputation. So in other words, it's not Christ's perfect life credited to our account, you see, because he got rid of active obedience. Instead, it's just simply the forgiveness of sins accomplished by the cross. Christ suffered passively, and doing that, he was not imputing righteousness. What he was doing is he was just forgiving sin, that we are forgiven of our sin. And that's where he came out on that side. So he would have reduced justification from an imputation of righteousness and a forgiveness to simply a forgiveness. And in doing so, Karg or parsimonious would have taken the view of moving the whole discussion away from the human nature to the divine nature, because Christ's humanity was necessary so that the God-man might be capable of being the Redeemer. Okay, so those are subordinate issues that occur in the middle of Osiander. So it's amazing. One controversy sparks two more. So there's a lot of theological research going on in the midst of this. Well, then Article 3 of the Formula of Concord of justification by faith, the document holds that Christ is our righteousness, not according to the divine nature alone, which is something that Osiander would have been interested in maintaining, nor according to the human nature alone, which is what Stancarp would have taught, but the whole Christ. God justifies of pure grace with regard to past, present, or future works of merit by imputing to us the righteousness of the obedience of Christ, which therefore rejects Karg's position. Okay? So there are actually three viewpoints that are being challenged in the Formula of Concord. Osiander, that was attempting to maintain that Christ as the divine presence within us, which is infused to us, is why we're righteous. And he says, no, it's not just, if you will, the divine nature, and it's not just the human nature, according to Stancarp, but it's the whole Christ, who is really in us in some sense, but it is his actual obedience that is credited to our account. So there is a real forensic maintenance which is against Osiander as well as Karg. It is faith alone that is the medium and instrument by which Christ is apprehended. Justification is a declaratory or forensic act, a sentence of absolution from sin, not an infusion of righteousness. Now, in doing this, it seems to me, we have to be aware that Luther was not this precise. Okay, that's the only thing I want to make clear. That Melanchthon, when he was writing later on in his apology for the Augsburg Confession, he will say there are times there's this idea where we are made righteous, there are times when we are declared righteous in biblical language. And that's part of the Book of Concord. It's there. Now, I don't know how this is all interpreted in light of the full sweep of those who hold it, but there are some natural tensions in the theological development. Okay, so that there is now a greater precision in justification language that says it is an imputed righteousness that comes from Christ's active obedience credited to our account, and that is a forensic act. Okay, so it becomes far more precise, whereas I don't think it was nearly as precise in Luther. And Melanchthon says, well, both of these are presents. Here it's defining it very precisely. So I think you can actually see development. I don't want to argue that as though I can prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt, but it seems to me that this very debate was necessitated partially because Luther himself was not as precise as this. So it's not just Osiander's fault, if you will. Luther necessitated this very debate to take place, that at some point there was going to have to be a decision made. Well, how do we define it? Is it Christ's actual presence that makes us righteous? Or is it his perfect life that God credits to our account and is imputed to us, and God thereby declares us forensically to be righteous? Okay? It's not that Luther didn't understand justification. He did. It was the precision of the doctrine that the theological battles were working out. It was by faith alone. It's Christ's righteousness. But how? Well, that's what this debate had to solve. And I think you can see that, in a sense, this last concluding position is where the Reformed tradition comes out. As we in the Reformed tradition would see Article 3 of the Formula of Concord as being a good reformational statement and would largely say that's our theology. Okay. All right. The fourth great controversy here in the tradition of the Formula of Concord is the majoristic controversy, which again is very closely tied to the one we've just talked about, because the issue here is, again, a matter of salvation. How is a man saved? Are good works necessary? An attendant debate on justification, obviously, is what is the role, if any, of good works in a man's salvation? So it's actually all tied together with what's gone before. It's tied together with the synergistic controversy, because you can see if there is a human element of the will in salvation, does that imply that there is a penny's worth of good works that a man can do? Even if it's only a penny, do you do a penny's worth of good works? That's a natural question. And it also is tied into the Osiandric controversy, because what is the basis of your righteousness? What is imputed to you? Is there a little bit of your good works necessary somehow into this thing? And you can see how the antinomian controversy, that is, do we need the law? Because if good works are necessary, what defines the good works that are necessary? Is the law necessary for salvation? So all of these are closely interpenetrated discussions. Okay, under letter D, number 3. Luther and Melanchthon both taught that faith was always followed by the fruit of good works. So there's no question about the idea that good works follow salvation. They both maintain this. So both of the traditions that are emerging from Luther and Melanchthon would recognize this. But not as a condition of salvation, which is a free, unmerited gift of God. They would not want to say, show me your good works and then I'll show you you're safe. They'd say, do you have faith? If you have faith, you have righteousness. Okay, so show me your faith. Now live your faith out. Your faith is going to be dynamic and powerful and it will issue in obedience. But we don't worry about good works. We just look to see faith and let faith have its role. So that's the Lutheran model. Okay. George Major, professor at Wittenberg since 1539, which means he would have known Luther and taught under Luther's influence. He dies in 1574. He was one of Melanchthon's students and one of the framers of the Leipzig Interim. You remember after one of the major battle losses later on, there is a kind of a middle ground where there's a compromise where certain of the Lutheran principles are lost and certain of them are maintained, and that's part of this whole battle with Charles V that's going on. He helped frame the Leipzig Interim, which we don't have time to pursue today, but that's an important middle ground. I think the Adiaphora controversy actually emerges out of the Leipzig Interim. What are the things that are indifferent to the gospel that may be very Romish in appearance, but we can live with them because they don't challenge the gospel? That was part of the debate there. So the Adiaphora debate comes out of the Leipzig Interim. So, but anyway, during his sojourn at Eisleben, 1552, he maintained that the good works of the Christian are necessary to salvation. Okay, so that's a strong statement. That is, he meant this as a negative condition, not as a meritorious cause, and he made a distinction between salvation and justification. So you can see Major is doing something very fascinating here. What he was saying is that we must understand that salvation is broader than justification. It is a more of an expansive concept. Justification is a subset under salvation. I don't think Melanchthon and Luther were prepared to do that. They saw salvation as justification. And so Major is moving perhaps in a theological direction that is more reformed in thought. Because you see, the reformed approach will say justification is a subset of the covenant. And the covenant includes not only the declaration of righteousness of Christ, but also the infusion of the grace of the Spirit that begins a new nature. And one never comes without the other. And so Major is perhaps moving in a reformed direction. And I think many reformed theologians would be quite prepared to say good works are necessary for salvation. And that you can't talk about your faith unless somehow that faith demonstrates its reality and obedience. But do good works save you? No. But they demonstrate the reality of your faith in the presence of the Spirit. Okay? Comment? Salvation is the entire work of a man being made, delivered from the bondage of sin in his lost estate. Justification is one part of that. Okay, so, for example, in the Westminster Shorter Catechism, it talks about the three benefits that we receive from Christ that flow from our effectual calling, and they're justification, adoption, and sanctification. See, there are these three great benefits. Those are the subsets of the covenant, if you will. For Lutheran theology, it seems to me, the paradigm is justification is salvation. It doesn't go beyond that. That as soon as you move outside of justification, you are in a sphere that now is secondary to this idea of a man being saved from his lost estate and sin. From the Reformed viewpoint, it seems to me, you can move from justification to these other attendant benefits and still be talking about salvation, although not talking about justification directly. Okay? Does that make sense or not? No, it is a state. Okay? It is a real condition in which we live. So that we must recognize we're always talking about logical distinctions of salvation. In other words, there's never a time that a believer is saved that we're not dealing with justification in some sense because we're in the state of being declared righteous. But in that state, if we claim to be in that state and there is no sanctification process going on, the Reformed tradition is prepared to say, are you in that state of justification? Has that act occurred where you've been declared righteous? So that in the Reformed tradition, it seems to me there's a willingness to say that there is such a thing as a dead faith, a counterfeit faith, a faith that's not real, and that you must examine your heart and see if you might be a hypocrite. And for the Lutheran tradition, there's a fear that we would talk about anything along outside of faith. We must say, look at faith, the faith is alive. And they would say, you're destroying your assurance. And for example, in the Westminster Confession, they're prepared to say assurance may not be automatic. Okay, in the Puritan tradition. Now, in the more continental tradition, I think following Calvin, they want to say that assurance is of the very essence of faith. Okay, so in there, so there are differences of emphases that flow right out of this very theological issue. I think if you are careful in using the words, are good works necessary for salvation? If you're saying salvation is the broader sphere of God's redeeming acts, I think the Reformed tradition is saying yeah, would say yes. If you define it, are good works necessary for justification? The Reformed faith would say no. It's by faith alone. But that faith is never alone. Okay? It's always accompanied by all saving graces. And see, suddenly you're saying, well, once you move beyond the precise definition of justification, salvation encompasses all of what God is doing. And that means the work of sanctification also. Okay? So justification is always by faith alone. No other way. But it is never alone. Because justification is part of the covenant, part of God's saving work. And so it's a tricky question here. And the issue basically would boil down to this. Was Major right in saying that salvation is a broader category than justification? The Lutheran tradition would say no. The Reformed tradition would say, with a qualified explanation, yes. And that's one of the basic differences, I think, that we need to see here. That's right. Justification is an act. Salvation is very much act and process. It's both. Because justification is part of our salvation. But salvation also includes this ongoing application yet more and more of growing in grace and Christ-likeness. And that there are the means of grace where grace continues to build us up. So salvation is a process. Okay, and there's a sense in which I think the Reformed tradition would be prepared to say that salvation is an act if you're talking very narrowly about justification. But they want to say, but you must understand it's more than that too. It is a process of God's continuing to pour out his grace upon us until one day we were made perfect in righteousness in heaven itself, when we are finally saved fully in the fullest sense of that word. I'm not sure that that is correct. I'm not prepared to, I would want to study that a little bit more before that may be correct, but I don't remember him that as part of the controversy, and you may be correct on that, but I don't think he says it's only that sanctification is only an act. I think he would say it's a process too. Well, I'll have to think some more about that, okay? Because I'm not sure that I'm fully grasping the point you're trying to make here, okay? Let's talk about it some more after I've had a chance to meditate on it. Before we take our break, Larry, you had a comment after this book. We'll stop.
Yeah, I don't know whether you want to record.
Yeah. Well, I think you can find in Calvin's writings a very continual pattern of saying faith is an assurance, go hand in hand. And somewhere in England, there, and it's clear in the Westminster Confession, because assurance is not an automatic by any means. So where and when that first penetrates English theology, I'm not sure. But as you say, here's someone who's saying, we got to correct this and get back to an earlier stage. And yet it's fascinating that for Calvin, while he thought assurance was of the very essence of faith, he certainly insisted that the good works must be manifest in the life of the believer. He said, if they're not, they call into question the reality of... So he lived with a tension there of some sort. How can you have assurance and yet obedience? But that's the dynamic, I think, of what we're dealing with here. It's not an easy thing. For Luther, he was, because of his own troubled conscience, I mean, as you look at him, as he explains himself, he wants something that's black and white so he can say, this is done. I don't ever have to worry about it. And maybe it's not that easy. Maybe it isn't, because if you open up the reality that there can be a false faith, a hypocritical lifestyle, then you see assurance can't automatically be a guarantee. Okay, so what do you do? There, we have a problem here. And I think probably the Westminster approach is a valuable one, where it says we should seek full assurance of faith. And it may come quickly. But if it doesn't, don't despair. That doesn't mean you're lost. It may well mean that God's working with you in a wonderful way to root out sin out of your life, to draw you more deeply to Christ. And so I think the Westminster tradition really reflects the reality of the human experience. There are some people who come to a wonderful, settled assurance in Christ, and the Bible holds it forth. And if there are others who seem to be just as much in love with Christ and walk with Him, but who struggle long and hard about the reality of saving grace. And I think the Westminster tradition, which may sound like it's harsh, actually becomes very beneficial to that doubting soul, because it says you may doubt, and yet you may really know Christ. And the larger catechism then will actually invite the doubter to the Lord's Supper. It will not say you can't come if you're doubting. It will say, even as a doubter, if you are truly seeking the merits of Christ and resting in repentance and the finished work of the gospel, come to the supper. So you see, instead of it being what sounds like, well, what's wrong with these Puritans saying, well, you can't know, it's actually a condescension of mercy for those who say, but I don't have this assurance. Well, what do I do? And it invites the troubled conscience to come and experience the blessings of Christ. So understanding that has kind of changed my attitude. And long ago when I was studying, I said, what's wrong with these Puritans trying to make it so hard? But that's not why they were. They were saying the reality is some aren't sure. Well, what do? They sit on the sidelines and hope that someday God will give them assurance? Yes. But what do you do in the meantime? Don't sit on the sidelines. Get involved. Get active. Come to the means of grace, and maybe assurance will even come through these very things. Okay, well, let's take a break for a few minutes here. And we can see that these issues are living issues. Each of these things are significant to every believer who really thinks about them. They're not just dead history. We live with them. Okay, well, take...